You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A pair of UW-Madison scientists are the first grant recipients in a new initiative to better understand and potentially prevent giant glaciers from melting because of global climate change.
They are part of a collaboration called the Arete Glacier Initiative. The scientists want to find out if and how humans can prevent the loss of glaciers. And at the center of their research is the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica, often referred to as the Doomsday Glacier.
If left unchecked, disappearing glaciers could raise sea levels by more than 10 feet, reshaping continents worldwide and displacing millions of people.
To learn more about efforts to stop sea level rise, the two UW-Madison researchers join us. Marianne Hazeloff is an assistant professor in the Department of Geoscience. Marianne, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Luke Zoot is an associate professor in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. Luke, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Luke, the Arete Glacier Initiative, working to improve our understanding of glaciers and sea level rise. Of particular focus is the Thwaites Glacier in West Antarctica. Why is this glacier so telling?
Thwaites is an interesting glacier. It's named after a glacial geologist from Wisconsin that was a professor here a long time ago. And it's interesting because the bed of it, so imagine a glacier is a big piece of ice, but at the bottom, it's sitting on the ground. It's sitting on either rocks or sediment. But in the case of glacier, or in the case of Thwaites, the glacier bed is sloped backwards, which means as you walk away from the coast and towards the center of the continent, it actually gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And in situations where you have that bed that gets deeper and deeper and deeper, we call it a retrograde slope. If their front of them is up against the ocean, they can sometimes have an instability, meaning that as they retreat, they flux more ice out, which causes them to retreat more, which causes them to flux more ice out, which causes them to retreat more. And this can cascade in a way where that glacier could potentially retreat much more quickly than other types of glaciers. And it's particularly important for Thwaites because Thwaites is kind of like the plug in the bathtub for a lot of the other glaciers in West Antarctica in particular. It's sort of this high spot. And if you were to quickly drain the ice out of Thwaites or collapse it, all the other glaciers in West Antarctica would respond to it fairly quickly. And they would potentially start to flow faster and discharge ice into the water quite a bit quicker. So sometimes it's called the weak underbelly of West Antarctica because of this retrograde slope and because of this ability for it to potentially cause lots of destabilization, in particular the West Antarctica ice sheet.
It's been also referred to as the Doomsday Glacier. Why is that?
For the same reason, because it can quickly retreat and in it is the potential to cause sea level rise to go up, you know, quite a bit, you know, a couple of meters in particular, you know, a meter or so just from the ice in Thwaites and a couple of meters if you account for the other ice that's sort of bottlenecked by Thwaites being there. And if you remove that bottleneck of Thwaites and those start to contribute, you know, you can get quite a bit of sea level rise. And importantly, you could potentially get quite a bit of sea level rise in a short period of time. And that is sort of at the heart of the problem of, you know, how quickly is the sea level rise going to go up? Means that's how quickly humans have to adapt to it. And Thwaites is an area where you could potentially cause it to rise faster than in other areas which are more stable or don't have bed conditions that are as conducive to this relatively rapid retreat of the front.
Luke, what can you talk about the domino effect of sea level rise and if the wall of ice continues to melt? What impact does that have on communities and people migrating to higher land?
You know, part of the complexity of a lot of coastlines, especially like along, say, the east coast of the United States, is that the slope of the land is actually really shallow, something like maybe 1 to 100, which means if you walk 100 meters in or 100 feet in from the shoreline, you know, you'll go up 1 foot. So what that means is that if you have 1 foot of sea level rise increase in a particular area, you're going to have inundation of 100 meters of the shoreline. And not only that, you're going to bring the shoreline landward, but it's going to exacerbate all these other problems like tides and things like that. And in places like Miami, you know, I have big tidal sequences. And if you just raise the baseline water level, the effects of those tides will be felt farther inland, and you'll get more of these nuisance flooding events where places, you know, experience flooding during high tides. It's not necessarily even have to be attributed to a storm or anything. It could just be the high tide overwhelms the drainage capability of the region. And then if you add on top of that, you know, rain events, you can get compound flooding. And so by increasing sea level, you're sort of increasing the base level, and everything else has to adjust to it. It is sort of the bottom line, you know, in some respects. If you do that, everything else in the system has to adjust. And if you raise it fast, that means things have to adjust fast. You have to have resilience. You have to have planning in place to move these communities, you know, more quickly, or try to come up with other types of solutions to protect those types of communities. Whereas if it's slow, you have more time to adapt and things like that. And so coastal communities care a lot about sea level rise, but they also care about the rate, and they also care about, like, what can they do? You know, how much can their particular community withstand in terms of flooding and things like that for their community infrastructure?
Marianne, you are crunching numbers on this bottom line, developing a mathematical method to improve forecasts for how rapidly glaciers will slide into the ocean. What are you aiming to accomplish with your calculations?
At the moment, a lot of our research is focused on understanding the physics that govern how fast ice sheets can move. You might think of ice sheets as stationary bodies that do not really evolve in time, but they can surprisingly move quite fast at some times. And so a lot of our research is focused on trying to understand the mechanisms by which ice sheets and glaciers move. And a particular focus is the interface of the ice and the bed. So this small area where the ice sits on the bed, where we really have to understand the physics right to know how slippery the bed is.
Why do ice sheets move? What causes them to start moving?
Gravity is the main driver of ice, or is the driver of ice sheet motion. So if you think of honey being squirted on a piece of toast,
yes,
it would start moving like a very viscous fluid and eventually drip over your toast if you let it go long enough. Ice sheets are very similar in the way they behave, just on much longer time scales and on much bigger spatial scales. But the ice sheet can move by what's called internal deformation, like ice. But a much faster mechanism is the sliding of ice along the bed. So if you live in Wisconsin, there's a chance that you have at some point stepped on ice that was just a little bit wet, maybe, you know, early spring. And maybe you even fell down because it's so slippery. And the same goes for ice sheets. When they sit on a bed where it's just a thin film of water, for instance, then that can help the ice sheet slide along. And understanding that is really important in understanding West Antarctica.
We're talking about new research to better understand and prevent glacial melt with Marianne Hazeloff and Luke Zhu, two researchers with the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. Luke, your research for the Arete Glacier Initiative will work to create a machine to make a simulated glacier called a cryogenic ring shear. Can you walk us through this device?
Yeah, it's a cryo ring shear device. And so an analogy I like to use is that if you say you put an ice cube on a board and then you tip the board, what would happen is the ice cube would slide over the board, and it would maybe the ice cube would deform a little bit, but most of the motion would come from it slipping over the board. And so that contact right where the ice sits on the bed, right where the ice sits on the board, that friction is really important for regulating how fast it will move. You know, if the board's really bumpy, maybe it doesn't move as fast. If it's smooth, it moves faster. And so that zone right at the bottom of the glacier, right where it's at the bed, just like Marianne said, is particularly important. Now, the thing that's complicated is a lot of the times those physical processes are, you know, buried under miles of ice, right? Mm-hmm. We can walk around on the surface of them, but what we really want to know is happening, you know, in this small zone right at the bottom of the glacier that might only be a foot or 2 feet in depth, right where that ice is sitting on the bed. And so what we have at UW-Madison right now, and what is the focus of this project, is to build these machines. And so in glaciology, lots of work has been done through time by people going out on glaciers and monitoring things and doing theoretical advancements. But unlike in other sort of more mature sciences, a lot of those things haven't been tested in a real quantitative way in a laboratory setting. And that's simply because the laboratory experiments are very difficult to conduct. You need a lot of conditions to be just right, and they've been hard to do over time, especially experiments aimed at trying to look at this basal slip right at the interface. And so at Madison, what we've built is called a large diameter ring shear device. And we have one already. Right now, it's the only functioning one in the world. And we're planning to build a second one as part of this project that's underway. And what it is imagine a big donut of ice that's about a meter in diameter or 3 feet in diameter. And that donut of ice is pressed on top. It's sitting on top of another donut of sediment, right? Mm-hmm. And then those two things are pressed together with a huge ram. And in that ram pushes the ice against the sediment as hard as the glacier would push on its bed in the real world. And then that donut of ice is gripped from the top and spun in a circle over the bed very slowly, or at the same speed as the glacier moves. And when we do that, we can do a couple things. Importantly, though, we can spin it at a certain rate, and we can measure how hard it is to spin it that fast. Like if we spin it at 10 meters a year, how much sort of force do we have to put in to spin it that fast? If we spin it 20 meters a year, is that twice as much force or two-thirds as much or, you know, five times as much? And we can build this up systematically in a lab. And what that allows us to do is interrogate things called sliding laws. And the sliding law is sort of one of the two main constituent equations that you need for modeling ice sheets. And that's what the thing that allows you to take the gravity and take the geometry of the glacier and make a prediction of how fast it'll actually slip over the bed. In nature, it's really hard to do because there's so many things going on simultaneously that it can be difficult to untangle one part from the other. Mm-hmm. But in the lab, we can systematically change one variable at a time and see how it responds. And so it takes all the complexity of the real world and puts it in a system where we can control it. And then that whole thing is inside of a giant tub of antifreeze that lets us regulate the temperature to a hundredth of a degree. And then that whole thing sits inside a giant walk-in freezer. So we run experiments they take months to run one experiment. And but the data is really useful.
I wonder, can you connect this to basal intervention here, Luke, and how understanding how these ice sheets are moving, you know, what this could mean for artificially connecting, you know, the glacier to its bottom bed of ice?
So an analogy I always like to describe how a glacier moves is if you've ever played air hockey, like an air hockey table.
Yeah.
You know, you have that little puck and then you have the holes in the table that are blowing air up and they're sort of pushing the puck up. And if you flick that puck, it's going to go a certain speed. But if you turn that air pressure down on the table and that puck isn't floating as much and it's kind of bumping on the table and then you flick it with the same sort of strength, it's not going to go as fast and it's not going to go as far. At the bottom of a glacier, that air pressure is just like the water pressure. So if the water pressure is real high, it helps sort of float the glacier off the bed. And in gravity pulling it down the slope gets way more bang for its buck if the air pressure is high than if it's low. And so one strategy that people have proposed to try to help slow down glacier flow is to drill holes all the way through the glacier, so through, you know, 2 kilometers or a mile and a half of ice, and suck the water out, basically put a huge well down there and suck that water out and blow it up on the surface where it'll, if it's cold enough, turn to snow and fall down. And if you did that, if you pulled enough of that water out, you could turn down that water pressure, you know, you could turn down that air pressure on the air hockey table and more tightly couple it to the bed. This has been proposed. There's aspects of it that maybe haven't been all the way thought through or are hard to simulate in a natural environment. And so that's where the ring shear experiments in the lab comes into play. We can do that. You know, we can drill a hole through the ice and we can suck the water out from the bed. All the while, we can see what's happening to the bed as we're doing that. We can see what's happening to how fast the glacier is moving. And we can include a lot of these complexities that you might have in the real world, but that are hard to sort of put together from first principles without these types of observations as sort of a midpoint between the field and theory.
You know, Marianne, it may still take thousands of years for the West Antarctic ice sheet to perhaps completely melt. What is the urgency for your calculations right now? Why do we need to understand this, you know, if it does take thousands of years to melt?
So the main concern with the West Antarctic ice sheet is not so much that it will melt by surface melting because it's warm there. It's actually still relatively cold. It is the chance that the ice sheet might slide very fast into the ocean. And as you put ice cubes on a glass and, you know, your glass might overflow, similarly, this can raise sea levels. So it's a response in which the ice sheet can move very quickly, and this can go much faster than melting alone. While it can be triggered by, for instance, ocean melting, the response is actually can become self-sustained and fast through dynamic processes that are internal to the ice sheet rather than, you know, just melting at the surface.
Which brings us back, Luke, to the collaboration at hand for the Arete Glacier Initiative. It's MIT and Dartmouth, UW-Madison, other universities that have other capacities. Can you talk about the perhaps, you know, the challenges of coordinating all of this research?
Yeah, so the research is largely coordinated by our colleagues at Dartmouth and MIT, and they sort of do, you know, all the hard work that Marianne and I don't want to do of, you know, putting the foundation together, looking for funding, things like that. And then people like Marianne and I get to benefit from it. You know, we have to propose ideas that sort of could be interesting under the types of things that Arete wants to look at. So Arete kind of has two main focuses. One is to just improve the fundamentals of glaciology, you know, just how do we improve sea level rise predictions by understanding the fundamentals of it better. And then, you know, the other one is evaluate ideas that have the potential to slow sea level rise. And so, you know, it's got sort of these two arms of what it's trying to do, and they're interacting with each other and they're crisscrossing and things like that. And so what we try to do is look at these ideas, some of these ones that have been put out there, and see, are they viable? Are they not viable? What types of problems do they have? What types of problems do they don't have? And, you know, Arete is kind of agnostic to it. They just want to know the fundamentals better. And so that's the types of things that Marianne and I have proposed to do.
Luke and Marianne, thank you so much for breaking down your research, taking us inside the research, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That is Luke Zoot and Marianne Hazeloff. They are in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison, and they're part of the Arete Glacier Initiative. That's a coalition of researchers who are exploring if and how humans could prevent the loss of giant glaciers and prevent catastrophic sea level rise.